Welcome to Healthcare Rounds. I'm your host, John Marchica, CEO of Darwin Research Group and faculty associate at Arizona State University. Here we explore the vast and rapidly evolving healthcare ecosystem with leaders across the spectrum of healthcare delivery. Our goal is to promote ideas that advance the quadruple aim, including improving the patient experience, improving the health of populations, lowering the cost of care, and attaining joy in work. Please send your questions, comments, or ideas for Healthcare Rounds to podcast@darwinresearch.com. And if you like what you hear, please don't forget to rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Let's get started.
This week on Healthcare Rounds, John welcomes Jason Gorvick, CEO and a member of Teladoc Health's Board of Directors. Since taking the reins in 2009, he has led Teladoc Health to its position today as the world's leader in virtual care, achieving significant growth in revenue, membership, and telehealth utilization. Under his leadership, the company has established a proven track record of successfully shaping the market and driving healthcare transformation by executing on the strategic vision, delivering award-winning innovation, and effectively integrating each corporate acquisition. Nationally recognized as a thought leader and trailblazer in the virtual delivery of healthcare, Mr. Gorvick is fueled by a passion for improving healthcare outcomes and providing universal access to care. His extensive career in healthcare began at Oxford Health. He has also held executive leadership roles at WellPoint Incorporated, now Anthem Incorporated, and Empire Blue Cross Blue Shield. He holds a Bachelor of Arts in International Relations from the University of Pennsylvania.
I'd like to welcome Jason Gorvick, CEO of Teladoc. Thanks for taking some time out of your day to speak with me today. I really do appreciate it.
Thanks, John. Happy to have the opportunity and looking forward to the discussion.
So before we get into some telehealth questions, of which I have quite a few, I don't know that I'll get through all of them in our time, but I'm curious, take me back to 2009. What was behind your decision to go from being really in an executive position in a pretty big company to coming to, I won't say a startup, but a much smaller organization? Like, what were you thinking at that time?
Well, it was definitely a startup at the time. And I will say it was a question that a lot of my friends in the industry were asking at the time as well. I got, quite frankly, condolence notes from friends in the industry saying, hey, I thought things were going so well. If it doesn't work out, give me a call. Maybe we can help you. From my perspective, actually, it was the most logical decision. If I were an investor, I'd probably be a macro trend investor. You know, I had a fair amount of background personally in early versions of virtual care or remote care, having run a nurse advice line for a health plan, having built an e-visits or deployed an e-visits platform for a health plan in sort of the early days of that. And so I saw the opportunity, which at that time was really more promise than reality. But I also thought all the macro trends were kind of lined up behind virtual care in terms of the proliferation of broadband, the use of mobile technology, the sort of opposite directions that supply and demand were going relative to the provision of care. And, you know, I thought that the digital age had finally matured enough for people to think about getting care differently. And, you know, it took a little longer than I thought, quite frankly. But I would say the growth trajectory has been stronger over the last probably 5 years than I would have anticipated.
Well, I'll tell you, not many CEOs have an opportunity to experience this massive growth. I mean, in your tenure, you've raised substantial amounts of capital, you've taken the company public, and you've orchestrated several high-profile acquisitions, including InTouch and Livongo. So what has it been like? You know, I'm a small business CEO, and we've been growing pretty rapidly, which is nice, but no, you know, I'm just curious, in your environment, what has that been like to lead an organization like that?
I mean, I think that probably the best word is exhilarating, right? It's rewarding. It's never dull. Every day is different. Every hour is different in the day. but it's exhilarating because we're doing something that matters. We're everybody here is here for the mission, and that creates real alignment and unity of purpose. And growth is fun, right? We're always building something new. We're always breaking new ground. You know, it's hard to be the innovator. Sometimes you take the arrows, and I've got plenty of scars to show for it. But it's also fun and I think intellectually challenging, but also rewarding to know that we're making a difference.
What about culture? Because sometimes when you're, you know, growing at this kind of rate, it's hard to, you face cultural issues, the stress on the organization sometimes. So how have you been able to manage through those cultural issues, if any?
Yeah, I mean, I think the culture has to evolve with the organization, but it has to be grounded in a couple of things. A really unifying mission, very strong values as an organization, and it requires very deliberate work. Like I always say, culture's, okay, my team is sick of me saying this, but I say culture's like a marriage. If you don't work on it every day, it goes in directions that you may not really like. And I think that's true for culture in an organization. And it can't just come from me. It has to be something that is part of the fabric of the organization. And everyone within the team carries a part of that responsibility for driving our culture to what we want it to be, not what ends up happening if you neglect it.
Totally agree. You know, at the start of COVID-19, we started tracking, like a lot of other analysts, but we started tracking the use of telemedicine. We had a quarterly study that was going out. And I talked to a lot of healthcare executives from some pretty big systems who stood up telemedicine initiatives overnight. But they were basically, you know, let's do Zoom, let's figure out how to you know, how to integrate Zoom into our workflow. But I'm curious, how did Teladoc respond in the early days of COVID-19 and then really over the last sort of 2.5 years of the pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, you ask what it's like to run a growth company. Running a growth company is exciting and exhilarating. Well, I would say, honestly, the early days of COVID were exciting and exhilarating and terrifying. Because all of a sudden, overnight, the world was looking to us to solve the problems. And all of a sudden, all the offices, the physicians' offices were closing. People needed care, but they didn't know where to turn. And, you know, we were sort of at the epicenter of that. And it what was amazing to me and really just incredibly inspiring was how much that was a catalyst for innovation within our team. You know, overnight, our visit volume doubled, and we had to figure out how to onboard thousands of physicians. So we had a system that was kind of, and processes that were built for onboarding tens of physicians at a time, or, you know, maybe dozens if we were really pushed. And yet we had to onboard thousands of physicians to meet the overnight explosion in demand. And, you know, that was terrifying because we take our mission really seriously and we believe, like, one of our core values is keeping our promises. And those promises are to our clients, to our members, to the physicians who use our platform. And we had to make sure that we could deliver on that promise. And it took us about 10 days. So there were about 10 days of just intense round-the-clock effort from the team to come up with solutions that enabled us to scale that rapidly. Fortunately, our underlying technology platform was really robust and could handle the scale, you know, the massive increase in scale and volume, but we had to really re-engineer a lot of processes in order to support the explosion of growth.
So without getting too much into the weeds, how do you go from hiring tens of people to hiring thousands practically overnight? I mean, that's just mind-boggling.
Yeah, no, it's true, and I think the big thing was sort of no sacred cows with respect to our processes and the way that we ran things, challenging all our original assumptions, streamlining processes that were in place for a changing regulatory environment, right? A lot of the rules were suspended, for example, relative to state licensure that enabled us to open up the doors and enable physicians to practice across state lines, because that was no longer required. It required us going back and changing rules in our system that are there, that are designed to enforce compliance. But in this case, we had to actually reverse that out. So it was really, really hard. But it was, like I said, it was around the clock effort. We stood up 24/7 teams that were working all shifts in order to do it. So we went from throughput that would be in a 10-hour day and using all 24 hours, for example.
Wow. So just one little side question around payers. You know, in the very beginning, we had parity for televisits. But then in our research, we started picking up, actually one of our clients asked us to ask the question around reimbursement. We started picking up that some of the payers were not paying at parity, let's say a year into it. What have you been seeing reimbursement-wise, kind of like the 30,000-foot view? What's going on with reimbursement for virtual visits?
Yeah, I think it's shifting over time. I think one of the things that we've always acknowledged from our perspective is it's more efficient to deliver visits virtually than it is in brick and mortar, where you have all the capital expenses of that real estate, and those are fixed expenses. So we've always tried to match the reimbursement levels to our cost of delivery more closely than what I would say brick and mortar can do, or maybe more sharply than brick and mortar providers can do. As a result, we've always contracted with payers directly for our virtual visits at levels that are typically below what an in-person visit would cost. So I would say for us, it hasn't changed much in terms of reimbursement. For our provider clients, where we bring them technology platforms for them to deliver care, they've seen what is more often than not parity in terms of payment. And the payers want to make sure that the visits are being delivered with the same quality of care. And it's not just a virtual visit in addition to an in-person visit, and therefore duplicate claims that are coming through, or two types of claims for the same situation. But I would say, you know, I said it's shifting. And really for us, the reimbursement is shifting along with the role that we're playing in the healthcare system. So more and more, we're standing up whole person solutions where we deliver on the full portfolio of our products and services, ranging from primary care and virtual urgent care to mental health, chronic condition management. And therefore, we have the opportunity to share in more sort of broad-based risk arrangements and more value-based reimbursement structures with our payer clients.
Interesting. Yeah, I've got a couple of questions on that. And I guess to lead in another 30,000 foot question is big picture. You know, as you see it, what's the current state of virtual care? And I guess the sort of the follow up, it would be what's working and what's not working, what needs some attention.
Yeah, I think the market is really in transition from what was, I think, a collection of point solutions and a bunch of smaller, you know, providers of individual condition programs. And it is moving toward a real whole person approach to care. And that's fundamental to our philosophy and our strategy. We believe that putting together all of those capabilities into an holistic approach makes for a solution that is greater than the sum of the parts. And we're seeing that in the buying behavior of our clients who, you know, last quarter, 80% of our bookings were multi-product bookings, where they're buying multiple solutions in a whole bundle that works together for their consumers. And we're also seeing it in the usage patterns of consumers, where, you know, 40% of our primary 360 members are now using more than one of our clinical services. The growth rate of people using multiple telehealth services is about 8 times that of the new entrants into telehealth overall. So we're seeing that behavior play out very much in keeping with our philosophy and leveraging our broadest array of clinical solutions in the market.
It almost feels like, I don't know, maybe you don't see the analogy, but I kind of cut my teeth in the ACO world doing research in that area. And, you know, in the best of all worlds, it's chronic medication management. It's, you know, checking for certain indicators, you know, diabetes indicators, obesity. And if it's done right, that ACO is supposed to be managing that whole person. Not always done right, but that's at least the goal. So I in doing my research for this, this interview, I saw the term virtual first. So how would you envision a virtual first healthcare system, and what kind of impact does that look like for primary care? And I'm also thinking, given in terms of like provider burnout, increasingly people leaving the healthcare system. So talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah, there are a lot of questions in there, John.
I know.
So let me start with the concept of virtual first. Virtual first is a consumer behavior, and then it's also a plan design, right? A financial plan design for a health plan or a health product. And we're seeing both of those, right? So we're seeing consumers who really want to engage with the healthcare system in a virtual first manner. And our virtual primary care, Primary 360, is really designed for that. And then we're seeing health plans stand up plan designs that encourage that behavior with financial incentives, right? Where your copay is waived if you have a virtual visit first, or and then if you go see a specialist, but you're referred by the virtual primary care, then that specialist visit copay is waived. Or if you're referred into the emergency department from a virtual first encounter, then your emergency room visit is copay is waived. And all the way up to if you have, you know, an expert medical opinion that's delivered for you prior to having a surgery, you're going to have a different cost structure for that inpatient visit for that surgery relative to your deductible, for example, than if you just go to a specialist, you know, sort of bypass the whole virtual structure and end up having a surgical procedure. Now the good thing is it's one of the few places where the plan design actually aligns with what the consumers want to do. You know, frequently there it's been a stick approach rather than a carrot approach. And in this case, it's a carrot approach that aligns with the consumer behavior that we're seeing. But you can only do it well if you have a really broad-based set of clinical capabilities that meets the consumer's needs in that virtual first setting. If everything is just sort of virtual first as a new version of a gatekeeper, then that doesn't work, right? And so the benefit we have is we bring such a broad array of clinical services that really meet the consumer's demands, and therefore it provides real value for them. And then, John, you asked about provider burnout. What we actually see, and you know, I sometimes have a hard time when I have this conversation with some of my friends who run hospitals, we're actually the beneficiary of that. So, you know, we see physicians coming to us and nurses coming to us who have been armed in PPE for the last 2 years in really a very difficult physical environment, either inpatient or in brick and mortar, in an office setting. And they're burnt out of that. They want to keep practicing. They want to keep delivering care and taking care of people, but they want to do it in a way that is, I don't know, more responsive to the rest of the way the world is going in terms of flexibility of hours, flexibility of where you work, and recognizing the fact that they've been in a really difficult environment. So we see, quite frankly, more people, more physicians coming to us than we have a need for at this point because of exactly that.
I can see how that would be true. Going back to what you said just before that, does this virtual first model also apply to chronic condition management, or is it really just a kind of a primary care thing?
No, we're bringing all of our products and services to bear in those kinds of relationships. And in many of them, you know, we're in a situation where we get the opportunity to share in the savings that we generate. So we want to bring those chronic care solutions to the consumer. And a good metric around that is, you know, of our primary 360 members with diabetes, prediabetes, or hypertension, we're actually 25% of them are newly diagnosed by our primary care or virtual primary care solution, P360. And so it's not just taking care of the people who have already been diagnosed in a physical environment and now they're coming to us, but rather we're actually discovering the condition and then deploying our chronic care management solutions to them. And what's really nice and gratifying from sort of a mission perspective is about 50% of our chronic beneficiaries, those people who are taking advantage of our chronic care solutions, live in underserved communities. And so it's a way to bring those capabilities to those who just wouldn't otherwise have the opportunity and the resources to take care of those conditions.
Do you go as far as the use of technology like blood pressure cuffs in the homes, scales for people with heart failure, things like that?
Yeah, all of those. And all of them, number one, cellular connected. So sort of least common denominator relative to being able to gather the data. So that's for blood pressure cuffs, for scales, for blood glucose monitors. And that sits on top of a data platform where we apply data science to help understand what works relative to each individual consumer and therefore change their behaviors for the better such that they can better manage their own conditions and then brings a coach or a physician to bear in the event that they need them. So absolutely, we deploy those kinds of technologies. We incorporate that into our overall delivery of care, and it's both physical and mental. So, you know, we know that if someone is living with diabetes and they're suffering from anxiety or depression that's untreated, they're less likely to have to manage that condition in the best way, because anxiety and depression, when untreated, leads to, you know, binge eating and sleeplessness and lack of motivation to exercise, all of which are significant contributors to uncontrolled diabetes.
So I know it's all about the care of the patient. We're all in alignment on that. At the same time, I spent a few years on the research side in home healthcare, and I'm wondering if that industry views you as a competitor.
I think ultimately...
Or a threat, I guess I should say.
I don't think so. I think ultimately we work with the home care industry sort of writ large, but maybe in a different fashion. So more and more care is going to move into the home, and that starts with self-administered diagnostic testing. Right. So we've broken the seal with home-administered, self-administered COVID tests. And what I think you're going to see is a whole proliferation of those kinds of diagnostic testing that can be done in the home. But it also goes to us dispatching someone to your home for, like, you know, home phlebotomy or even home care, where a nurse can be or a medical assistant can be dispatched to your home. And then they can bring in a physician, one of our physicians virtually, to expand the scope of what can be done in the home. And so I think we're actually going to see sort of three tiers or three categories of care. That which can be done fully virtually, then that which can be enabled virtually but done in the home, and then that which really needs to be done in the office. And we play a slightly different role in each part of those. You know, for the home version of it, it's getting you the resources you need and being able to expand the scope of what can be done in the home. And then for the in-person care, where you really need to be seen in an office, the role that we want to play there is to make sure we get you to the best doctor who's going to care for your specific needs most effectively for the best outcomes and most efficiently at the lowest cost. And we're not tethered to any particular part of your local medical system that sort of influences that. Rather, we can just make the best referral the first time.
Got it. So one other term that I ran into doing my research, and that's whole person healthcare. What does it mean? What does that term mean? And where is it headed?
Yeah, our philosophy is that someone who's living with diabetes doesn't think of themselves as a diabetic. And someone who's living with depression doesn't think of themselves as just a depressed person. People think of themselves as a whole, right? They think of themselves as people who have various things going on in their lives. And our job is to take care of that whole person. And the only way you can do that is to bring a broad array of clinical services and treat the person as a whole, right? And that starts with recognizing that our systems are all interconnected, right? Just like mental health care and chronic conditions interrelate with each other, so do, you know, someone who's living with a chronic condition but comes down with an episodic, you know, situation, whether it's a virus or something else, ends up, those affect each other. And so understanding the whole person enables us to be able to deliver more holistic care and ultimately lead to better outcomes. It's really focusing on health rather than focusing on a just individual illness. And the way to do that is to really, number one, bring together broad-based clinical expertise with underlying data science that looks across the entirety of someone's health spectrum, but also their physical activity and what they're eating and how much they're exercising and what their daily routines are. And then finally, understands that digital solutions are not sufficient and human expertise and resources are scarce. And therefore, the best way to care for a person is to marry those two in sort of a stepped care fashion, such that we're delivering both digital solutions, underlying data science, and the best care that the best professionals can deliver for a consumer.
It's almost like the holy grail of care coordination, right? I mean, everybody's trying to do it, has been trying to do it for some time, but being able to leverage your technology, leverage your processes, and leverage your people to be able to take that kind of ACO approach, that whole person approach, and looking at everything all at once. I'm going to give you one last 30,000 foot question. CEOs get the 30,000 foot questions. What does the future look like in virtual care? I mean, I get the snapshot in time. We talked a little bit about some of the challenges, but if you were to look out, you know, 5-10 years, what does the future look like to you?
I mean, I think the future is incredibly bright. And the reason I'm so excited about it is because I think virtual care has the opportunity to deliver not only better outcomes, but a more personalized healthcare experience that ultimately yields more consumers changing their behavior to live healthier lives. And then also has the opportunity to really engage the disenfranchised. So, you know, when we look at our virtual primary care, Primary 360 product, 59% of the people who are using that product haven't engaged with a physician, haven't seen a physician in over 2 years. Right? Those people are disenfranchised from the healthcare system. And because of that, they're likely having clinical conditions that they don't even know about. And that's when we end up with exacerbations, right? When we're too late because something has manifested itself and gotten worse over time. So I think we really have the opportunity to engage people in their own health in a way that has really never been done before, because we're delivering care on their terms rather than making them make a pilgrimage to our healthcare system, which is impersonal, inefficient, and really difficult to navigate. And so I think we have really the opportunity to totally transform that healthcare experience.
Wow. Jason Gorevic, this has been a pleasure. It's been great getting to know you a little bit over this last half hour. It's inspiring to see the work that you guys are doing. It's obviously very mission-driven. And this space is really exciting. You know, I remember doing a project profiling, we'll call them virtual health companies, back in 2017. Of which Teladoc was one. And things have changed so much. I mean, this isn't my primary field, but I have to study it to keep up on it. And it's amazing where we are in 2022 versus, you know, 5 years ago. It's incredible.
I appreciate it. Thanks, John. It's exciting, and it's an exciting time to be doing what we do. And we did. We went through a bit of a time warp where all of a sudden everything massively accelerated as the world woke up to the possibility of virtual care. and we're excited to be the leader in that space.
Thanks again. Much appreciated. Thanks, hope we can keep in touch.
Definitely. Take care.
Take care.
From all of us at Darwin Research Group, thanks for listening. Healthcare Rounds is produced by me, Kim Ishudo, and is engineered by Andrew Rojek. Theme music by John Marchica. Darwin Research Group provides advanced market intelligence and in-depth customer insights to healthcare executives. Our strategic focus is on healthcare delivery systems and the global shift toward value-based care. Find us at darwinresearch.com. See you next round.